Behind the Bite podcast is part of a network of podcasts that are good for the world. Check out podcasts like the Full of Shit podcast, After the First Marriage podcast, and Eating Recovery Academy over at practiceofthepractice.com/network. Welcome to Behind the Bite podcast. This podcast is about the real life struggles women face with food, body image, and weight. We're here to help heal, inspire, and create better, healthier lives. Welcome. Well, hello, hello. So excited to be here today with you guys. So the other day, it just so happened that I got a few calls in a row into my private practice, and they were from parents who were, rightfully so, very concerned about some of the behaviors they were seeing in their kids. And they wanted to know all sorts of things, including if I was even the right person to be calling. And you know what? I completely get it. Seeking mental health services is really not a very well understood process by a lot of people. And just in general, it's really confusing. But when someone is trying to seek help for disordered eating or an eating disorder, it is even more confusing and difficult. Oftentimes, people don't know who to contact or what help even looks like. It can be confusing to understand even once I try to explain it to someone in a brief phone consultation, because quite simply, it's not quick and simple to explain. There really is a lot to it. And as a parent myself, I can completely understand that trying to take in so much information when all you want when your child is hurting and you want to get them help is really, really difficult. So I thought, why not have an entire podcast discussing all of this to really break it down so that anyone out there listening can understand what to do if you think you or someone you know needs help from an eating disorder. After this podcast, I really hope you can walk away knowing how to seek treatment, what the different levels of treatment are, and really just have an overall better understanding about eating disorder treatment in general. And then I thought, well, who do I bring on to talk about this? And I thought, well, who better to bring on than a guest who's out there, who has years of experience treating eating disorders, and who's currently treating them on all different levels of care. Dr. Michael Wetter is a clinical psychologist with over 25 years of experience, who has a private practice in Los Angeles and is the director of psychology at UCLA Medical Center, Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine. He's an adjunct professor of psychology at Pepperdine University and has served in leadership positions at nationally ranked hospitals, including Kaiser Permanente and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Dr. Wetter is an award-winning author of books, including Earn It, What to Do When Your Kid Needs an Entitlement Intervention, and What Went Right, Reframe Your Thinking for a Happier Now. Both can be found at Amazon. And I'm so excited to have him on. So welcome, Dr. Wetter. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here. Nice to speak with you. Thank you so much.
So, you know, it's been a while since I've actually seen you or spoken to you. We actually worked together at Kaiser a very long time ago.
Eons ago.
Yes.
Yes.
So we're both in very different positions now in our careers, but so exciting to hear what you're doing now. Would you mind talking to us a little bit about what position you're at and what you're doing now?
Sure. And thank you for having me on your podcast. I enjoy it immensely. And I think it's a valuable resource for so many out there. Currently, I sort of do a couple of different things. I have my private practice, which is located in Los Angeles area, where I, you know, work with clients both in person as well as through telehealth. And then I also serve as the director of psychology at UCLA, specifically in the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine, where I oversee and clinically work in two distinct programs for eating disorders, one of which is an outpatient clinic that's called Nourish for Life. And the medical director for that is Dr. Elaine Rosen. And she started this program about 4 years ago. And we also have a second program that sort of, if you will, coincides with this, although it's not directly related, which is the medical stabilization program. And the medical stabilization program is for those individuals who require to be hospitalized on an inpatient level because their weight has gotten so low that it's now dangerous and it requires more direct feeding and supervision from a medical standpoint so they don't experience refeeding syndrome or other some of the other medical complexities that can come with being malnourished. So there are sort of, I see kind of both ends of it. I see where it becomes really quite progressed and advanced and serious in its nature. And I also see it on the outpatient level from the perspective of initial assessment. So people coming in from the very get-go who really don't know what's going on. They may not even be aware that there is an eating disorder. There may not be an eating disorder, but it's our job at that level to sort of do a comprehensive assessment from a medical standpoint, where Dr. Rosen will be the pediatrician and specialist there who does a complete evaluation and assessment. On my level, the psychological assessment to see what's going on that front. And then we also have a dietary component where our dietitian will also meet. And we sort of put our three relatively good-sized brains together and we come up with one super brain assessment and make some recommendations from there. So that in a nutshell, in addition to lecturing here and there and, you know, the occasional high quality podcast that I'm invited to do, that's what I've been doing.
That's amazing. And, you know, I'm just listening to that kind of assessment and thinking, okay, how does somebody even get in the door to get that kind of comprehensive assessment?
Yeah, it's, I will tell you this, eating disorders were certainly not created by the COVID pandemic, but the COVID pandemic did not help eating disorders at all. Right. And we now have waiting lists for our program that stretches into even now, February of 2022, for anticipated, which is a lifetime for a concerned parent. You know, it's a lifetime. And we do our best. Our program is also experiencing unprecedented growth where for the past 2 years, it's been really just the three of us. And now we've been approved to hire more staff, which we're really looking forward to, but it takes some time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what gets somebody to our program, which is unique in our area, which is surprising given Los Angeles and the demographics, but we really are unique. What gets them there is usually a recommendation or referral from either a pediatrician who's treating a child who's concerned about weight loss or anything else for that matter, or it's word of mouth and from other families and other parents and people who just start speaking and looking into resources and so forth. So, but yet, you know, it's very different than, let's just say, calling up somebody, a therapist or psychologist in private practice saying, I think my child has an eating disorder, and starting the ball rolling there. Here we really do have that comprehensive approach where we can really look at it from all angles. And I think that way, when we make a recommendation of what we think are the next best steps, whether it's working with us, needing a higher level of care, or something else for that matter, they know they're getting it, not just from a singular perspective, but really comprehensively.
So now, do you just do the assessment, or do you actually also treat the patient that comes in?
One-stop shopping. I assess and I treat.
Okay.
And well, the treatment modalities that we tend to use include, you know, CBT for those who are more adolescent focused or young adults and focused in that regard, or FBT, which stands for family-based treatment.
Okay, so you work with the families of adolescents and younger folks.
Yes, and I would go so far as to say I work more with the parents than sometimes the extended family, as you know. And again, this is probably more a product of COVID, where interactions were really sort of severely curtailed by hospital and clinic policies about who can come and who can't come. So ideally, what we would like to have, you know, siblings and extended family members who live and present in the house and who contribute to the family milieu participate, that hasn't always been an option in the past year and a half. So it really is kind of, you know, shrinking it down to those core essential members of the family.
So this part you're talking about is the outpatient,
that's the outpatient
program. So, you know, for listeners who may be a little bit confused, can you discuss a little bit about the difference between the what would qualify somebody for an outpatient, level of care versus the other part you were talking about, which are even the higher levels of care? Like when you get somebody and say, okay, they are somebody we'll treat in an outpatient basis. Like, how would you determine that?
Sure. And let's be very clear. we're all confused to a certain degree and a certain level. Okay. Doctors, physicians, you know, nurses, clinicians, and dietitians, everybody has their own opinion and everybody's confused. And so it would be arrogant for me to say, I know the distinction and let me tell you what to do, but I'll give you my impression and my philosophy when I consider that. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are multiple levels of intervention for everybody that comes to the door. The first thing you have to assess, you know, more than anything else is, what are we treating? Mm-hmm. Okay. What is the disorder, if there is one? And, you know, some of the more common examples of what we see are certainly anorexia nervosa, the various subtypes. We also see some degree of bulimia nervosa, and whether that is in the context of anorexia with binge purge mm-hmm. cycles, or more specifically, a specific bulimia nervosa independent of anorexia. Mm-hmm. And then we also see a high degree of ARFID, okay, mm-hmm. which is avoidant, you know, restrictive feeding intake disorder. And then sometimes we see nothing at all. And they just come in because they didn't realize that this, you know, there was more disordered eating than an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of a point of clarification. What will really determine the disposition and the most effective recommendation is, where along the line of the continuum of the particular disorder does the patient fall? So for example, I'm just going to stay with anorexia nervosa right now, not to minimize the other disorders or conditions, but rather because that seems to be the most prevalent one we've seen, you know, most recently. And to be fair, extremely dangerous, as we all know. Is how far along is the particular individual in their malnourishment? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we are starting to talk about people who are presenting who are either tachycardic or bradycardic, where they are experiencing dips in their phosphorus, in their production of whether it is glucose to the brain or whatever else it may be, we're seeing compromised functions in their blood work and metabolic workup. And you know, as you well know, probably in seeing it, when you sit with someone and they just have brain fog, where mm-hmm. you really can't connect with them and their ability to concentrate, relate, emote, and express is compromised. When someone's reached that level and we're concerned about their medical stability, we're not even at that point in time concerned about psychotherapy. The goal right now is to preserve life. Right. And that's where medical stabilization is required. So that would require inpatient hospitalization on a medical unit. Mm-hmm. The average length of stay being about 10 days. And at this point in time, the focus is on really making sure that the individual is getting the nourishment and nutrition that they need. This doesn't mean healthy food. It means all food is healthy at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And we have a very specific protocol of which we follow, where the amount of calories and the nourishment is really dictated by the dietitian of the service, supervised by the hospitalist and overseeing physician. And it's steadily, you know, potentially increased every day, depending on what the needs of the patient are. The goal is not to get fat. The goal is to become medically stable. The hardest part for these patients is the understanding that improvement means weight restoration to a certain degree, which means gaining weight. Mm-hmm. And that is completely so terrifying to someone who is suffering from an eating disorder. So the role of the psychologist in this particular, and I'm talking now specifically about my role, mm-hmm. when it comes to medical stabilization and inpatient hospitalization, it's not therapy, which is so contrary to what parents often think their child needs. Where's the therapy? They're suffering. The primary focus right now isn't therapy, and that's because the brain is malnourished. When the brain is malnourished, cognitive functioning is impaired. Psychotherapy at this point in time is like banging your head on a wall. You're not going to get anywhere. So really, my role is one to assess what is the degree of impairment, what are the other underlying potential psychosocial and emotional affective cognitive things at play? Are there any other comorbid psychiatric diagnoses that we need to be aware of? Lending support, psychoeducation, not only to the patient, but to the family, mm-hmm. and then coming up with an appropriate disposition after they reach medical stabilization, what comes next in the treatment, which is often the springboard for the rest of their care. So all those things go into play. And so it's not uncommon for someone to come into our clinic, our outpatient clinic, thinking they're going to receive outpatient services, and in fact find out that day they need to be hospitalized.
Big shock, right?
Big shock, okay? But at the same time, it's a big shock, and more often than not, it's a big relief.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big relief because it's now about safety. And the parents feel the sense of relief because, one, it's validation that something actually is going on, and two, that their child can get what they need. There's an underlying philosophy to what we do, which is food is the medicine. Mm-hmm. And that's really sort of the underlying current, and I would say the predominant message that we give families when they get in the hospital is food is medicine. And there may not be medicines that you like or taste, you know, to your preference, but we still have to do it. And we're going to do it in the most, you know, supportive mindful way we can. But it's still a challenge. And I think parents feel the most relief knowing that their child is safe. And one of the things that I make a point of trying to convey, especially at the outset of the hospitalization, is, look, you know your child, but we know the disorder. And what we want to do is collaborate. And how do we work together so that you can get your child back from this disorder, which is more often than not taken over if it requires hospitalization? So that's the one level. I can mm-hmm. do a deep dive on that all day, every day. But that's the one level of care. And that I would call that the most restrictive level of care. They're in a hospital bed. They're not going out. You know, they're really sort of confined to that treatment milieu at that point in time. I'm just going to go down the ranks in terms of least, you know, from most restrictive to least restrictive to explain the various levels of care.
Sure.
So let's say somebody makes it through that hospitalization in a period of, like, say, 10 to 11 days. They are now medically stable, where any cardiac issues have been sufficiently restored and attended to. Metabolically, they're stable. Okay. Mm-hmm. Psychologically, they may still be distressed. They may have had a shift in their thinking, mm-hmm. any number of things, but they are ready to be discharged from the hospital. Typically, at that point in time, we recommend that the next level of care be residential treatment. Residential treatment is where the individual will actually stay at the treatment facility. Here in Los Angeles, there are typically houses that are nicer than what I live in. Okay. They're palatial, they're mansions, and you have upwards of about anywhere from maybe, you know, 7 to 12, you know, kids. Usually, if we're talking about adolescent group, anywhere from about, you know, 12 or 13 up to no older than 18 years old. Usually 18 is a cutoff for an adult program, where they are all invested in a program that provides immersive treatment. So all their meals are had there. There is sort of round-the-clock activities and processes that occur that can address the treatment. And that includes group therapy. It includes individual therapy. It includes nutritional therapy. In most cases, it involves opportunities to participate in some form of schoolwork so they don't fall so far behind. Really, what residential provides for many of these patients, more than anything else, is an immersive treatment experience. And the way I sort of explain it to parents when they're saying, well, we really want to try to manage this on an outpatient basis. Can't they come and just get therapy once a week or even twice a week and do well? And, you know, the analogy or metaphor I will often share with them is, well, let's say you wanted to learn French. Okay. My daughter Leia is taking French in school this year, and she can identify with this metaphor. Okay. If you want to learn French, I can tell you, look, I've got this guy. His name is Pierre. Okay. Pierre is from Paris. He's a great guy. He knows his stuff. He knows French. He can come over and work with your child 2 hours a week to teach them French. Okay. And he is fantastic. Like I said, he knows the language backwards and forwards. And we can do that for about, oh, let's just say 6 months. Okay. Or I can send your kid to live in Paris for 2 months. Which way do you think they're going to learn the language in a more comprehensive, and again, key term here, immersive way? What are they going to take more value from? It's no slight on Pierre. Okay. It's not a slight on him. It's the process. And that's where residential treatment really is so critical oftentimes for the patients who need it. It's the immersive experience of it. Okay. And I would venture that for many of these patients, you know, it is a shock to the system because the child is not being confronted. It's the eating disorder that's being confronted, and it has nowhere to run. And that's where you can sort of burst through. Average length of stay depends again on the particular facility, and it depends on the individual as well, but can be anywhere from about 8 to 12 weeks. And from there, we have the PHP level of care, which stands for partial hospital programming, which is ironic because it has nothing to do with the hospital. It really is kind of like day treatment, where the same types of programming are afforded, which is individual, group, you know, medications as needed and if needed, as well as dietary. The difference being is you're going every day, but you're coming home at night. So it's kind of a step down and, if you will, transition from residential to now matriculating back at home. After PHP comes IOP, which stands for intensive outpatient programming. There, again, you are staying at home. You're not going every day of the week. You may be going anywhere from 3 to 5 days a week. And instead of having breakfast, lunch, and dinner there, you may be just having, you know, breakfast or lunch or some combination thereof. Again, the focus now is less on the medication aspect of things, but more on some individual as well as group therapy. And from there, we step down to what is considered to be traditional outpatient. And that can either be in a program like where I work, where it's, you know, sort of a team approach of physician, psychologist, and dietitian, or a ad hoc team, which is consisting of a private practice clinician, dietitian, as well as pediatrician or physician following along. So, like I said, there's so many different places to get confused, you know,
right.
Where do I go and where do I start? And I think the most important part of all of this is getting the initial assessment, not making the assumption that this is the level of care that my child needs, but really getting that professional assessment and recommendation of, this is where they can best be served at this state and at this place in their diagnosis.
Well, and I think the way you're doing it is fantastic. Now, I, you know, as someone who's in private practice who does more of what you described as the ad hoc, right? Bringing in...
I'm part of the ad hoc system as
right?
well. Nothing against ad hoc.
You know, right?
I live in it and I breathe it. So I got nothing, but it's nice to have a team.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest frustrations is trying to find someone who is in the medical field who is well-versed in eating disorders as well. And so I don't know how you've been finding that in that level too. There's a lot of maybe conflicting information or maybe even conflicting assessments going on. So for somebody who might be listening, where would you suggest? A lot of people first go to their pediatrician or they first go to their medical doctor and maybe not a therapist or psychologist. So for anyone listening, would you suggest they actually go to a psychologist first?
Well, that's as a psychologist, of course, I'm biased.
Right.
but I'm a big believer in that the data tells the story. Mm-hmm. So I think what is important is start with gathering your data. So if you suspect something is wrong, I would definitely go ahead and set up an appointment with your pediatrician, if for anything, just to have a very important piece of data, which is the growth chart. Let's see, you know, what has been the trend in terms of, you know, weight or weight loss over the past, three, four, 5 years. If we see a precipitous sort of drop, we know something is really wrong. If we just see that, you know, one or two pound difference, maybe we don't have to sound the alarm just yet, but we can start to explore it. But that data is valuable. That data tells a story. I would get that first, and then I would pursue, a consultation, an assessment with a psychologist. I think the key here is someone who actually does know eating disorders. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look on various therapy referral resources, a lot of people are very quick to refer to themselves as an eating disorder expert or that they deal with eating disorders.
Right.
And, you know, again, it's not my job to criticize or assign blame to others, but I will just make this mention. Not everybody who is listing everything on their site as a specialty can also be a master of everything. And when we're talking about eating disorders, you really want someone who knows the beast, if you will. Mm-hmm. Okay. Someone who's very well versed in the pathology, the psychopathology, the behaviors associated with it, what needs to happen, the various levels of care. You will know very quickly if you select the wrong person, because they will tell you very quickly, I am not the right person. Okay. Because the minute they see the level of severity in some cases, they will realize that they are out of their depth. Okay. And they are out of their scope of practice. You know, eating disorder is very different than someone who struggles with weight loss. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Eating disorder is very different than someone who is just a picky eater. And I think that this is where, even though you're feeling pressured and quick and you want to act out of desperation to find somebody, you want to find the right person and not just any person. It will save you more time and more aggravation in the end to do that investigatory work. And sometimes it's even asking, saying, you may not be an expert, can you recommend somebody who is?
Right. And I guess to your point too, you know, there's been a lot of times I've gotten somebody in and not even looked at the weight issue, right? You brought that up in terms of medical mm-hmm. necessity and, you know, somebody being on the brink of even death. And I find a lot of times it's the behavior and the eating disorder and the illness, and it has nothing to do with what they actually look like on the outside or their weight. Right. And so that can oftentimes really throw people, because parents, teachers, other doctors, providers can say, well, you look fine. You must not have an eating disorder.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've never heard someone, I shouldn't say never. It is rare that I've ever heard a teenager or a patient in particular who says, I started off wanting to be anorexic.
Right.
Okay. The number one thing I hear is, I wanted just to be healthy. So I wanted to try to start to be healthy. Parents hear that, they're like, yes, be healthy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Go for it. Whatever it is. It's such an insidious and seductive disorder that it happens before you even realize it's happening. And if you don't know what to look for, you are going to miss it. And not because you're a misattuned parent. It has nothing to do with you being a good or bad parent. You love your child. You're there for your child. It's that it starts off in an innocuous way, which is, yeah, I just want to eat healthy, or I just want to lose a few pounds, or, you know, as we've heard now, I just didn't want to be that. I didn't want to have a COVID body, you know, and I had more time to myself, and I just didn't want to, it could be any number of things. So it's not always about, you know, the number on the scale. Okay. It's not always about the size pant or skirt or dress. You know, you can even have atypical anorexia where the person is actually still considered to be overweight relative to what they're recommending, but it's the history, it's behind it. You know, one of the things that I try to, you know, again, adopting a user-friendly language, as best I can with parents, is the act of eating, of being nourished, would never be an overly emotional activity. In other words, someone shouldn't derive ecstasy from envisioning the next meal. And by the same contrast, someone should not be terrorized at the thought of the next meal. Mm-hmm. And when those are present, when we look at the emotional context that it occurs in, that's one of the things that we can look at in terms of determining the eating disorder pathology.
Exactly. And you brought up something interesting, you know, the ecstasy of eating. And how often do you actually find people that you treat for binge eating disorder?
I mean, it's prevalent. It's there. Okay. Interestingly enough, prior to my work at UCLA, I used to work in a department of surgery for bariatric surgery. Okay, and doing a lot of bariatric, you know, surgical weight reduction processes and procedures. And one of the things you would screen for is binge eating present, okay, because that's going to result in some severe medical complications if they continue with that behavior after surgery. Okay, after you've removed perhaps 80% of the stomach associated with a sleeve gastrectomy, if you continue to binge, you're quite literally going to bust a gut. So the, you know, I'm very familiar with the pathology that comes with binge eating. And it rarely is it ecstasy. It's more about sort of the self-soothing that comes with binging. Okay. And by the way, as we talk about sort of the emotional impact of either binging or in restricting in some cases, I think it's important for parents to understand that the act of restriction doesn't just set off the pleasure centers in the brain in a, you know, kind of in a psychopathological manner, but that it also acts as a numbing agent. You know, I call, you know, anorexia is what I consider to be emotional Novocaine, and that the more you restrict, the less you feel. And except when you start to eat, that's where the anxiety manifests and it bursts through. And not to be surprised that when we start to become more nourished and weight restoration begins, that Novocaine wears off. And now we're left with all these things. And so I have parents saying, my child is looking worse. They actually sound worse than when we brought them in. I'm like, worse emotionally? It's all been there all along. You know, if you have a root canal and they don't use Novocaine, you're going to feel it. Okay. And when they use Novocaine and the Novocaine wears off, you're going to feel it. They didn't make it worse. And that's a really important thing to bear in mind, is that's why medical stabilization or weight restoration isn't the end of treatment. It really is just the foundation for the treatment that is yet to come.
I'm so glad you said that, because I get so many parents I work with, well, they're following their meal plan, they're weight restored, we don't need treatment anymore. And I'm going, oh my goodness, that is, that's not it. That's not what's happening here. That's not the eating disorder just being done now. So I'm so glad you cleared up two things. One is like food for pleasure and ecstasy is not binge eating, right? It's
exactly.
Using food for something else. I'm glad you cleared that up. But also, it's not just the behavior that is okay. Now the behavior is better, the eating is better, and now the illness is gone, because that's not it. There's underlying issues.
It would be like saying, you know, you're the captain of the Titanic, like, oh, we see that little tiny iceberg there, we got that, you know, and not realizing, oh my God, it's the behemoth underneath that's going to tear us, you know, apart. It's, you know, there are so many traits that are consistent with, you know, the eating disorders and specific anorexia nervosa that we don't want to acknowledge are traits of the disorder, but rather that the disorder hijacks for its own purposes. So, you know, we see, you know, individuals who are highly driven, highly intelligent, you know, who are perfectionistic in their tendencies, who tend to, you know, need things to be a certain way. They're routinized in the way they do things. And again, we look at this, you know, I can't tell you how many times parents come in, you know, my daughter or son, you know, is a straight A student and they play three different sports and, you know, they have intentions of going to Yale or to Oxford or to Stanford or to Berkeley or whatever it may be. And, you know, so I know they're fine because they can do all that and they're doing great. And it's like, that's exactly the reason why they are so advanced in their anorexia nervosa, is because whatever traits and capacities and strengths your child has, so does the anorexia. So you can't just stop with, well, now they can go back to being a straight A student and driven and everything, because that anorexia hasn't gone. It's just silent.
Exactly. Right. I'm so glad you brought that up too, because let's see that with so many people I'm working with is it, those criteria. Exactly. And when I ask them those things, it's like, my gosh, that sounds just like me.
Well, I frame it as a game. I said, I'm going to play a game here. I'm going to give you my game of assumptions. And you tell me if I get it right, or you tell me if I get it wrong. And they're like, how did you know that? Yes, he's been going through our garbage. You know, what does he know about me? You know, and it's like, have I hacked their system? It's like, no, this does not mean that those traits are bad traits. They're just being hijacked and used by your disorder in a negative way that's working against you versus for you.
Right. Well, Michael, I know I've spent a lot of your time here today, and you said so many great things that I hope people are really listening to and can really, you know, help guide them for when they are hopefully seeking treatment if they think they might have an eating disorder and need to go in for an assessment. And maybe some parents can have some clarity now about what the levels of treatment are, because I do think there's a lot of confusion and a lot of it's like a mystery out there. Like, what is it all? Do you have any last words or anything you'd like to say before we end?
Any last words? I hope I have many, many more words to come for years to come, but I'm never at a shortage of words. I think there's also an important thing just to say, and I would encourage your listeners to pursue this more in their reviews, which is the different treatment modalities, okay? Mm-hmm. Which includes, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is CBT, as well as family-based treatment, FBT, and a quick qualification, FBT, family-based treatment, does not equal family therapy. I think so many parents are quick to be like, yes, we'll all get in there, we'll all do what is necessary. Mm-hmm. And it really needs to be quite extensively explained that what FBT really represents, it's putting the parents in charge of the patient's food and nutritional recovery. And that parents are often shocked when you begin FBT that the psychologist or therapist you're working with actually is meeting with you, the parents, not your child. Because the first goal is, again, weight restoration, nourished brain, nourished mind. That's when therapy can occur. So I would encourage parents to really understand FBT more before you just say, yes, we're going to jump into it. What I will often say is FBT is really creating a residential treatment program at home. A residential treatment program, for one, it can often mean that you have to take time off of work, that you have to be there at all hours, that you are essentially going to be the bad guy in the eyes of your child's eating disorder. And how to get through that. But it's what's so wonderful about it is treatment in the past usually excluded the parent in the treatment of eating disorders. And now you are agents of the treatment, if not the head of the treatment, so to speak. And that your treatment team members, psychologist, dietitian, and or physician are there to support you. So I would just encourage parents to look into those distinctions and to have an understanding. And if you don't, ask the psychologist or therapist you're working with so that you do have a better understanding of what you're signing up for.
Oh, I'm so glad you clarified that too, because I do find that is very much misunderstood. So thank you for that. Yes, I think I'm glad that there's more education out there for parents too. Just there's a lot more information on the internet too. And I do think that's part of our jobs as psychologists to educate parents. So thank you for all of the information you just provided. It's very helpful and useful. So
never ask me if I have anything more to say. But thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. So if people do want to find you or learn more about the program you just discussed, how can they find you?
Well, the two different paths. Certainly you can explore UCLA and UCLA Health. We're in the process as an organization of reformulating our website. So we don't really have a strong web presence right now because it's all being done and was put on hold a little bit as a result of the pandemic. However, you can contact UCLA Adolescent Medicine Department and say that you're interested in learning more about the Nourish for Life program. You don't get any discounts or priority by mentioning my name, so there's no benefit to doing that, but you certainly can get through and learn more about the program there. In terms of me and my private practice and so forth, it's a very narcissistic link, drwetter.com, that's it, and I'm happy to field any questions or provide any consultation that people may have.
Fantastic. And if anyone missed any of that, I will have all of that information on the show notes, so don't worry about that. It'll all be there. All right. Michael, it's been so great to have you on the show and reconnect with you after all these years. Thank you so, so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
This podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regards to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, accounting, clinical, or any other professional information. If you want a professional, you should find one.